Okay, it is November 15th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. Bob Willemstad. Mr. Willemstad, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today. My name is Chris Seifer. I'm with the FCIC. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report to Congress by the end of this year. That statute tells us to look at many things, including the role of derivatives, and it tells us to look at every institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. Those are a couple of the reasons we're looking at AIG and, of course, the reasons why we thought it made sense to talk to you, given that you were on the board and then ultimately CEO of that company in 2008. So as I said before we put on the recording device, before we get to the substance of the interview on AIG, could you please summarize your educational and work background, starting with college?
Yeah, 3 years of undergraduate college, and I've spent 40 years in financial services.
Okay, and where did you go to college, and what college did you graduate from, and what degree did you get?
I did not graduate at Delphi University.
Okay, and then where did you work when you left at Delphi University?
I spent 20 years at Chemical Bank, and then 20 years approximately with the successor companies of Citigroup.
Okay, and what were the years you were with Citi once Chemical was merged into Citi, I take it?
Well, Chemical didn't merge into Citi. I left Citi and went to work for what was then Commercial Credit, which ultimately turned into Travelers that merged with Citi.
Ah, okay.
It was 1987 when I joined Commercial Credit, and I retired in 2005 as the president and chief operating officer.
Okay. And is that when you joined AIG's board?
I joined AIG's board in February of 2006.
Okay. And just describe for us, please, the circumstances that surrounding your joining the AIG board.
Well, I was invited by the search committee of the board to join.
Okay. Were there, I mean, we know that in 05 there was the accounting problem that led to Mr. Greenberg leaving. Was this in connection with that at all?
No, not directly. I don't believe so. They were looking for additional board members, and I was approached in the latter part of 05.
Okay. And did you join the board as a director, or were you chairman at that point?
No, I joined as a director.
Okay. And when did you become chairman of the board?
I was voted on in September of 06. I think the first board meeting that I was chairman was either December or, I think it was December of 06.
Okay. And just so we have it for the record, at what date did you become CEO of the company?
June 16th.
Of 2008, right?
2008, yes.
Okay. And then when did you leave the company?
September 16th, 2008.
And that was as both an officer and a director, a complete split from the company?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay. So I suspect your counsel shared with you the areas that we wanted to talk to you today about involving AIG. And I think what I'd like to do first is just sort of start out generally and have you describe, in your opinion, what went wrong. What were the causes of the company's financial problems that led to the government assistance in September of 08?
Well, there are obviously issues inside the company in terms of some of its financial issues, but I would say the major event that took place really was the downturn in the markets and the crisis that ensued after Lehman filed for bankruptcy.
Okay. We'll come back to that weekend later on. Let me ask you about some specific areas. Describe for me what the board, what kind of information the board received about the credit default swap book, and if the type of information the board received changed over time from the time you joined the board in February of 06 through till you left the company in September of 08.
Well, the finance committee of the board was principally responsible for overseeing most of the investments that the company would make, which included the investment area as well as the financial products group. And so the finance committee was principally responsible for reviewing that information and meeting with the various management groups inside the company. And that information was fairly detailed and fairly complete, although certainly when I joined the board, most of the attention was on the investment portfolio, not the financial products group. The investment portfolio was some $800 billion, so obviously the board focus most of its attention on the larger areas.
Mm-hmm. And were you on the finance committee of the board?
I was.
Okay. And how often would the finance committee of the board meet, ballpark?
My recollection was that the finance committee was meeting monthly.
Okay, and would the finance committee get some type of package prior to the meeting?
Generally speaking, yes.
Okay, and would there be a separate package from the financial products group that would include information on the CDS book?
There was, but the attention on that didn't come till later. So it's the more detail was in the 07 time period.
Okay, and if it helps, it was in July of 07 that the first collateral call came in from Goldman Sachs. Was that around the time that there was increased attention paid to the CDS book?
Clearly, that was a period of time. I can't say that it was specifically July of 07. I think as the housing market started to show some signs of stress, there was more attention paid to the credit default swap book.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact dates.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned this, that more attention prior to, at some point in 2007, was paid to the $800 billion investment portfolio. Just generally, what was that portfolio comprised of?
I'm sorry, what was it?
What did it include?
The bulk of the assets in that portfolio were fixed income assets. A lot of the assets held are a function of regulatory requirements.
Mm-hmm. Did it include the securities lending business investments?
It did.
Okay. Do you recall ballpark about how big a chunk of that $800 billion that was?
My recollection, it was in the $70 to $80 billion range.
Okay.
Could you at what time?
Certainly I would say in the summer of 07, thereabouts.
Okay. So when did you admit, issues arise in terms of concerns about valuations of at least real estate related assets at AIG, whether it's the securities lending book, whether it's other securities, or whether it's the CDS book at FP?
Well, again, I would say it was sometime in mid-07, again, and it was just a byproduct of concerns that were both in the press as well as discussions at the finance committee about the real estate market.
Could I ask you just to clarify, Chris, to make sure we're talking about the same thing? When you talk about, when you use valuation, at least in my mind as I think about it, could mean either the substantive underlying values of the underlying assets, or it could mean the accounting valuation issue. Could you just, when you ask the questions, could you just delineate between the two so that we know exactly what we're answering?
Sure, and that was Mr. Gamble, wasn't it?
That was, sorry.
Yeah, okay. If you can, just identify yourselves, because I know you guys got multiple people there, just so the record's clear. Yeah, what I am talking about is valuations for financial reporting purposes. So, for example, on the CDS book, of course, there was a lot of there was the one issue of economic losses and whether cash flows would, you know, break into the super senior tranche versus unrealized losses based on the market value of either the synthetic instrument or the underlying instruments. I'm talking about accounting valuations when I ask those questions.
Okay.
Okay. So tell me how the company went about determining those types of values and if it changed over time.
Well, I mean, I can't give you the specifics about how the company went about determining the value. Obviously, in that period of time, the attempt was to market those securities. But of course, as 07 progressed, it was much more difficult to find a market value transaction that we could use to mark them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a formulaic approach to doing that.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. One of the things we saw when we were looking at AIG earlier in the year was, for the CDS book anyway, there was not a model to value the portfolio until one started being developed in the probably third quarter 07 time frame, when this modified binomial expansion technique model started to be developed. Do you have any knowledge about the valuation of the CDS book and or the circumstances that gave rise to the development of that BET model?
Well, again, the absence of an ability to mark those, because there was no market for these securities, gave rise to the formulaic approach.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we also found during our look at the company earlier is that several of the company's officers at the AIG level and some even at the FP level were not aware that the multi-sector book contracts anyway included terms that required FP to post collateral if there was a decline in market value of the underlying collateral. Do you recall if you knew that or when you found that out?
I don't. My recollection is that the board did not know that until there was a discussion about collateral calls from counterparties.
Okay. And again, knowing that the first collateral call came from Goldman in July of 07, do you think that's ballpark around the time the board found out?
It was probably after July of 07. My recollection, it was in the September-October time frame.
Okay. And what can you tell us, if anything, just to provide a little more color about finding that out in the September-October time frame?
Well, my recollection is that as we were looking at either the third quarter results, or at least an estimate for the third quarter results, there was a discussion about the valuation of the CDS portfolio, and that there would be some write-downs based on this formulaic approach. And subsequent to that, there had been requests for collateral from Goldman Sachs.
Okay. Back in, I think, late 2005, early 2006, around the time you came on the board, the Financial Products Group decided to stop writing CDS on multi-sector CDOs, at least to the extent they were backed by subprime real estate. Do you recall that decision being made at that time, you know, when you first came on the board?
No.
Okay. Do you recall when you, did you ever find out about that decision subsequent to joining the board?
Again, my recollection was in the fall of 07 when the issues surrounding the value of the CDS portfolio.
Okay. We've also saw just, and I think this is, if not from public filings, from information that AIG produced to us, in 2005, you know, before you joined the board, the multi-sector CDS book about tripled from about 17 or 18 billion to about 54 billion. And then, of course, as I said, at the end of 05, early 06, the growth went down tremendously because they stopped writing subprime. It still started to grow, but it didn't grow nearly as much. When you came onto the board, were you aware of that business, one, and two, were you aware of the growth in that business in 2005?
No.
Okay. We also learned from former executives AIG that the time AIG stopped writing CDS on subprime, super senior tranches of CDOs anyway, that thought was given to hedging the book, but after a couple of small hedges that were put on, the decision was made to not hedge the book. Do you recall any discussions in the finance committee or board level or otherwise about whether or not to hedge the super senior book?
No discussion that I'm aware of.
Okay, and you don't recall any that issue being brought up at finance committee meetings or board meetings in 06, 07?
No.
Okay. Do you recall any discussions about the book being reduced simply by trying to sell it?
At what period of time?
I'm sorry, again, 06, 07?
No.
Okay. Now, we also saw, and you may have seen this or heard about this, at the time that the Financial Products Group made the decision to stop writing CDS on subprime super senior tranches of CDOs, the securities lending business continued to go long on subprime and continued to increase their exposure on residential MBS backed by subprime. Do you recall that the securities lending business continued to increase exposure, you know, at the end of late 05 and into 06 and 07, while FP was at least stopping writing CDS on subprime?
No, as I said before, there was no, it's my recollection, there was no report to the board of knowledge about the discontinuance of the CDS portfolio writing those swaps.
Mm-hmm. Generally, do you recall, discussion at the finance committee level or board level about, the risks as the housing market started to decline, and whether there were discussions about either hedging real estate exposure, reducing real estate exposure through sales, et cetera, and what the different parts of the business were doing?
There was generally, again, my recollection is on the credit default swaps, there was really no discussion about hedging or selling any of that book in light of the belief that economically there would be no loss to that book of business. So that was the underlying view that was given to the board.
And then what about in other parts of the business?
Well, again, the securities lending business. Again, I don't recall any discussions about hedging that portfolio at all.
What about just discussions? Or maybe let me try it this way. What kind of information was provided to the Finance Committee or the Board in general on the securities lending business? And just let me tell you, the reason I'm asking about CDS and securities lending is that's where, you know, a majority of the losses came at the company.
Well, Well, again, there was a lot of information provided to the Finance Committee. You can certainly appreciate what information would be available on an $850 billion investment portfolio. And in fact, real estate assets were only a small portion of the total portfolio. So while there was information there, and had been given to the Finance Committee regularly, the significance of the real estate assets, or the mortgage-backed assets, only became significant in the latter part of 07 when the market turned.
Mm-hmm. Did the Finance Committee or Board look at the levels of either the CDS book or the securities lending business or residential investments as constant in relative to the company's capital as opposed to the company's total assets?
Could you just again define the time frame if you're talking about when they, you know, the late 07 period that Bob was talking about, or you're talking about before that? Again, that's Jamie Gamble, I'm sorry.
Sure. Don't worry about it. Actually, the entire time period, you know, from the time you joined the board in February of 06 through September of 08.
Well, again, I'm going to be repetitive here. The real estate-related assets, whether they were in the FP book or in the securities lending book or just the investment portfolio itself, was never an issue of concern up until the latter part of 07 when the housing market was deemed to have taken a turn. And there are any number of conversations about the size of the portfolio, what might happen to the housing market. The company at that time, certainly in 07, was deemed to be well capitalized and well properly reserved.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that it doesn't become a concern until 07 when the housing market turns. I'm just asking something just more general, and that is whether just as a matter of course from 06, 07, before things became a concern, whether the company was looking at concentrations essentially, and specifically concentrations to capital. So, for example, you know, the CDS book, you know, got up to about $80 billion by the end of 07, and in mid-07, that was about 100% of capital. And I think the securities lending business was even a little larger than that. Both of them, obviously similar in that they are exposures to U.S. residential real estate. So that's all I'm getting at, is whether the management was providing information to the Finance Committee or the board in general on these exposures as percentages of capital.
Generally, I would say no. And again, I just remind you, with an $800 billion investment portfolio, and as you pointed out, the company's capital was maybe about $80 billion. I mean, the investment portfolio was by itself 10 times larger than the company's capital. There were larger concentrations, my recollection is, in the investment portfolio beyond the mortgage market.
Mm-hmm. So within, I mean, obviously we know that now, you know, that most of the losses came from securities lending and the CDS book. Within that $800 billion investment portfolio, what were the concerns, you know, in the 06-07 timeframe before, I'm assuming, that the CDS book and the securities lending book become the concerns?
I don't think there were any concerns of any significance. Again, in 06 and 07, the company was doing extremely well. There was a record level of earnings. The credit quality of the portfolio, as reviewed by the board, generally characterized by the rating agencies, were all often described as AA, AAA rated securities. So from a Finance Committee perspective, it was deemed to be a very high-quality portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe generally the interactions between the Finance Committee and PricewaterhouseCoopers?
Well, I mean, again, the PwC would I'd say in most cases be present during those meetings. Finance Committee would get reports from PwC about its work and its review of the portfolio.
Did they ever raise any concerns about any of the investment portfolios?
I'm sorry, could you say it again?
Sure. Did PwC ever raise any concerns about the investment portfolios?
No. Not that I can recall.
Okay. I know that we've seen, for example, there was a meeting on, I don't know if you were in this meeting, but there was a meeting on November 29th, 2007, between PwC and representatives of the Financial Products Group and of AIG, the parent, where amongst other things, they told folks that, you know, one, they were concerned about the valuation of the CDS book given the collateral calls and the lack of a model or lack of a fully developed model at that point. And two, that the fact that what we talked about a little earlier, that FP had stopped writing CDS on subprime CDOs while the securities lending business continued to go long on real estate. Does that jog any memory bells about PwC ever bringing up those kinds of issues with the Finance Committee or the board?
I can recall discussions about the lack of refinement in the modeling process and also PwC's view that confirmed that there was no active market to value these securities.
Mm-hmm. What about the apparent, I don't have the minutes in front of me right now, but the differing approaches by the securities lending business and FP, and generally I remember them describing that as somewhat of a risk management failure. Do you recall any discussions about that with PwC?
Sorry, can you just give a time frame as to when you think that conversation happened? It's Jamie again.
Sure, same time. It's that November 29th, 2007 meeting.
I don't specifically remember, but again, I mean, they're not the same. The credit default swaps and the securities in the securities lending portfolio were two different classes of securities, so they have to be looked at individually.
Mm-hmm. They're both long investments in real estate, aren't they?
Yeah, but my recollection is that the securities lending were actually asset-backed securities, which were more easily valued versus the credit default swaps, for which there was little or no market to value.
Mm-hmm.
Be wrong about that, but that was my understanding.
Okay. So you probably recall that, you know, on December, there was that December 5th conference call where, you know, statements were made about the valuation of the CDS book, and then on February 11th of 2008, AIG filed the 8K that said, you know, here's this $3.6 billion negative basis adjustment that wasn't talked about back in December. Can you just walk us through your memory of the events that led to the 8K disclosure?
Well, I wasn't on the call in December, so I can't say specifically what was said or not said.
Okay.
I did have a meeting with PwC when they notified us that there was a difference in the valuation, the basis adjustment valuation. That was late in January sometime.
Mm-hmm. And who did you meet with at PwC and what did they tell you?
Tim Ryan was along with several of his partners.
Mm-hmm. And was it just you or were there other AIG folk at the meeting?
It was a meeting actually that was not a board or a committee meeting. It was a meeting that I had asked to have with them, unrelated to this, I might add.
And why did you ask to have a meeting with them?
The company was going through a major systems accounting, development effort, and I wanted to get PwC's view on how that was coming.
So what was the effort that the company was going through that you wanted to get their views on?
Well, after the 05 reporting issues, the Greenberg issues, as you referred to them, the company undertook a major development effort to reconstruct many of the accounting systems across the company. It was a big project that had been going on, and I just wanted PwC's view of how that was going.
Okay, and again, this meeting is in January of 08, you recall?
Late January.
Okay, and so what did they tell you about the effort towards the improving the accounting systems of the company?
Well, they had some concerns that it wasn't moving as efficiently and as quickly as we had all expected it to. But I knew that. That's why I wanted their opinion about it.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously at some point in this meeting they bring up the issue of the negative basis adjustment and the material weakness that leads to the 8K. But you had mentioned that, you know, you had asked for this meeting and obviously not for that purpose. So before we get to that part of the meeting, what else are they telling, what are the specifics about why things aren't moving as quickly?
Well, I think it was just the scope and the magnitude of the undertaking. The company with over 4,000 legal vehicles around the world, there were several hundred different general ledgers. So it was a large undertaking.
Mm-hmm. Any specific comments about the ability of management to get the job done?
No, I don't think so. I don't recall that specifically. It was always a question about enough resources.
Mm-hmm. But they, I mean, for example, you know, they weren't saying, you know, look, the CEO or the CFO or the chief risk officer or the chief accounting officer or whatever executive, you know, wasn't getting it done. You needed to replace people or things like that.
No.
Okay. So describe for us what they say in terms of the material weakness and the negative basis adjustment that leads to the 8K getting filed on February 11th.
Well, they just mentioned to me that I believe the day before, and again, my recollection was the previous day, in reviewing their audit work for the fourth quarter, they came across, and I'm not sure specifically how it transpired, they came across that there was a different, the basis adjustments that had been made were different than what had been disclosed in the prior periods.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any discussions with them about whether PwC knew about the negative basis adjustment earlier than this discussion, you know, that you were having with them in January of 08?
I don't recall.
Okay. I mean, as you may know or not know, when we looked at AIG, and in fact some of this is on our website, there are more than a few indications that prior to the December 5th call, you know, documents indicate that there was a negative basis adjustment included in that valuation estimate that was given during the December 5 call. Do you recall any discussions in this January 08 timeframe or otherwise about PwC? You knew this back then?
That the board would have known about it before December 5th?
No, well, no, that PwC knew about it before December 5th.
I'm sorry, I'm confused.
Okay, sure. Here, let me try to, because it's something actually that I've been curious about. As I told you before, there was, during this November 29th, 2007 meeting, one of the things discussed during that meeting, you know, was the valuation of the CDS book and the Goldman collateral calls, etc. And during that meeting, there are documents that indicate the valuation included a negative basis adjustment, and there are different documents that actually indicate the amount of that negative basis adjustment, or at least the approximate amount by doing some math when you read the documents. And then, of course, you know, December 5th call comes, and I forget the numbers, but I think it was like $1.5 billion when you add in the losses from October and the estimates for November. But then, you know, PwC comes to, this is, other people have told us this too, PwC in January comes to the company and says, hey, there's this negative basis adjustment, you need to file an 8K. Yet we've seen documents that indicate PwC knew about it back in late November. So that's my long-winded way of saying, does that jog any memory bells of whether or not there were discussions with PwC in January of 08 to the extent of, hey, you guys knew about this back in late November, why is this just coming up now, and why do we have to file an 8K?
I don't recall the specifics. My recollection of the January meeting was that the methodology that was used, whether you call it negative basis, was different for the December meeting than had been used in our financial reporting for the end of the third quarter. That's my recollection of what actually transpired, and the first I had heard about it was at that January meeting. I don't know that specifically answers your question, but that's the best recollection I have of what took place.
Okay, and then why did they say an 8K needed to be filed?
Well, again, for the reasons I just described, that it would have been, their view was that it would have been required to be disclosed in the December call that the valuation methodology was different than the valuation methodology that was used for the third quarter reporting.
Okay, and do you recall any discussion again about when they are talking to you about this, any discussion about their knowledge before the December 5 call, the fact that the valuation methodology was different?
No.
Okay. What did they say, if anything, about responsibility for the failure to disclose back on December 5th?
Well, I think their view was the responsibility was the management of FP to have properly disclosed that they had changed the valuation methodology.
Mm-hmm. And did Mr. Ryan or the others at PwC tell you that PwC did not know about this until the January 08 timeframe as they were completing their audit work?
I don't recall them saying that they did know.
Okay. Now, we've seen that there was apparently another meeting between Mr. Ryan and Mr. Bob Sullivan of PwC and you on February 6, 2008. So I think this is probably a different meeting, but tell me if I'm wrong, where, and there's some notes that we've seen that PwC produced, that regarded, you know, remediation steps that were being implemented, but, and then included a long list of concerns they had with management and with management one and two risk management practices at the company. Do you recall that meeting, even if you don't recall the specific date?
Was this a regular finance committee meeting?
No, I don't think so. From what I can tell from the documents, it was just a separate meeting between yourself and Mr. Ryan and Mr. Bob Sullivan, as opposed to Martin Sullivan of PwC.
I honestly would say I don't recall a meeting just with the three of us. Sullivan would have been at the January meeting that I described.
Martin or Bob?
And when you say Sullivan, yeah, which one do you mean?
PwC Sullivan.
Okay. Okay, well, maybe it's the dates then. But I will tell you that the PwC produced notes of a meeting that purportedly, anyway, took place on February 6th. But I'll just read you a couple points that they made during the meeting. Maybe that'll jog memory bells. You know, and they according to the notes, told you that the company needed to make sure that Martin Sullivan was truly committed to changing the way AIG was run and managed from an internal control perspective. If the board chose to keep him as CEO, that the board needed to make sure that the CFO, at that time Mr. Benzinger, could compensate for the CEO's weaknesses, and that some of Mr. Sullivan's weaknesses included a difficulty in holding people accountable for internal control related matters, making difficult decisions, experience with large scale change, lacking execution skills, that Mr. Benzinger wasn't compensating for those weaknesses, not being sure that Mr. Lewis had the proper skills to be a chief risk officer, and it goes on. So generally, you know, the gist of the meeting as set forth in the notes was PwC's concerns with executive management at AIG. Does that jog memory bells in terms of the meeting?
It does. I do recall it now. It was actually a dinner meeting.
Okay. So if you could just walk us through that meeting and I guess where it was, since I just always assumed it was at AIG.
And I'm just Jamie Gamble again. I just want to. I realize you're pulling from documents and information you've assembled over a very long and complicated process that you've gone through.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to have Bob respond and answer. I just want to be clear for purposes of others who may eventually listen to what we're talking to now that, you know, by answering your question, Bob obviously can't adopt or comment on your characterization of what it is PwC did or didn't say or did or didn't record in their notes. That said, I'm happy to have him describe the meeting in his recollection. I just want to be clear that he's not adopting what you're saying by answering it.
Oh, of course, that's perfectly fair, and all I want is Mr. Willemstad's best recollection.
Great.
We had dinner in a restaurant. Not sure I can remember which one it was. Once again, the meeting itself was more a matter of course, in a sense that periodically I would meet with Tim Ryan just to talk to him generally about how things were going and the efforts that were being made in the company. So my recollection was that there was not a specific agenda surrounding any number of the things that you described. I do recall other, not the specifics, but that PwC expressed some concerns about the management structure of the company.
Mm-hmm. And I take it, given the recollection, that this is a different meeting than the meeting in January about the 8K. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. And the reason I ask that is because you had mentioned you would have periodic meetings with PwC. It just seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that this was not one of those periodic meetings, since it seems to come pretty close on the heels of the meeting in late January that leads to the 8K.
Again, I don't recall who requested the meeting or whether it was a, quote, periodic meeting or not. Obviously, mm-hmm. it took on a tone that was a byproduct of the disclosure issues.
Okay. Now, after the company filed the 8K on February 11th, at the end of the month, it reports 4Q07 and year-end 07 results. And about that time, I think, is when the Mr. Cassano's retirement or resignation from FP is announced. Can you walk us through what role you had, if any, in Mr. Cassano leaving the company? What were the circumstances that led to him leaving?
Well, I had several conversations with Martin Sullivan about the reporting incident and the responsibilities for it.
And just so the record's clear, the reporting incident is the 8K?
Yes.
Okay. And what was the gist of those conversations with Mr. Martin Sullivan?
Well, we discussed whether Mr. Cassano was the right one, whether he was the right person to continue running the business after the disclosure issues, and I think we both came to the conclusion that he should not continue to run the business.
And why? What was the basis for those conclusions? For that conclusion?
It was a function of the one, the disclosure issue. Obviously, it should have been disclosed differently in the December meeting, or should have been disclosed if the basis was changed. And I think the ongoing concern about whether his view of the business and the financial exposure the business had was appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any discussions with Mr. Cassano?
Did I have any discussions with
him? Yeah.
No.
Okay. You mentioned, in addition to the valuation issue, another point you raised was just Mr. Cassano's view on managing the business. What did you mean by that?
Well, just that he had very strongly took the position that there would be no economic loss to the company.
Right, and so what was the concern with that, if any?
Well, I think the concern was whether it was more to being responsible for running that business as to just whether there would be an economic loss, that the accounting losses themselves were material and that should have been greater sensitivity to that. Mm-hmm.
When you had the meetings with Mr. Sullivan about Mr. Cassano, any discussion about, you know, whether others knew back before December 5th that there was this negative basis adjustment?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Sure. And let me back up. I mean, and again, we've, you know, from talking to different people and looking at documents, it seems fairly clear anyway, certainly not determinative, but fairly clear, that the whole issue of this negative basis adjustment was known about before December 5th by other people at AIG and by PwC. So I hear you saying, although not by the board, so I hear you saying that, you know, there was concern about, you know, the lack of disclosure on December 5th and the 8K on February 11th, but I'm just wondering if there was discussion because of what we have seen in the documents and heard in other interviews, and that is, other people did know about the negative basis adjustment before December 5th. It doesn't appear to us, or at least to me, that the negative basis adjustment was only known about, you know, by Mr. Cassano or others within the financial products group. It looks like it was known by people at AIG and by PwC.
Again, it's Jamie. I'm going to, obviously, I'll let Bob answer the question, but I do want to just, again, for the record, say that Bob is not, there's a look at the documents to which you're referring.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all he can really testify to is what he knows. He can't testify to what other people know. He can testify to his own recollection. I know that's all you're asking for. I'm just doing this to make sure the record is clear.
And this is Rob Carrangelo. I just want to add to that is I think, Chris, a lot of questions, what you're asking it and the way you're suggesting it, that there's a whole host of people who knew about the negative basis adjustment and knew about the particulars of it and the amounts of it, and I don't think that's the case. So just to make it clear, the question is pretty, has a lot of assumptions in it that may not be accurate.
And I appreciate that, Rob. I didn't mean to imply a whole host of people certainly knew. All I'm telling Mr. Willemstad and you guys is that there are at least, you know, more than a few documents and more than a few people that have told us that, you know, it was known about. And I'm sure you guys have seen this, or at least some of you guys have probably seen this stuff on our website that includes a little of that information. So, and again, but you're right, both of you guys are right, that my only point is to see if it jogs memory bells about, you know, discussions with Mr. Sullivan in this February 08 timeframe about Mr. Cassano leaving the company.
The Chris, I completely understand that. I just want to make sure that when somebody else looks at the record at a later time, they're not confused by the circumstances that I think we all understand.
Sure, sure.
You keep referencing the negative basis adjustments. Until there was a reporting period, discussions that may have taken place in the November time frame, my recollection, there were a number of discussions about, not a number of discussions, there were discussions about a number of different methodologies that could be used to value these securities in the absence of a mark from actual transactions.
Mm-hmm. So,
and the so-called negative basis adjustment was one of those, but since we hadn't reported anything at that time in November, except that at the end of the third quarter, those were just discussions about how to value the portfolio, as far as I was concerned.
So, other than yourself and Mr. Sullivan, anybody else involved in the discussions about whether or not Mr. Cassano stays at the company?
Not in my presence.
Okay, and then I think you told me earlier that you didn't have any discussions with Mr. Cassano, so I take it Mr. Sullivan then delivers that message to Mr. Cassano. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Okay. Did you hear anything back from Mr. Sullivan about how that conversation went?
No, I don't recall anything specific.
Okay. And generally, any pushback by Mr. Cassano?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Now, of course, we know that Mr. Cassano remained with the company as a consultant. Did you have any role in that decision to retain him as a consultant?
Well, Mr. Sullivan told me that he felt very strongly that should be done. I concurred with him.
And why did Mr. Sullivan feel strongly it should be done?
Well, again, at the time in February, there was still a very large book of business. It's a very complex organization. There were other credit default swaps besides the multi-sector CDOs. And the ability to retain the staff there was important. And the concern was that if Mr. Cassano left, others might leave as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what was Mr. Cassano, what was his function at the company once he was no longer head of FP but a consultant to the company?
Well, I can't speak to that specifically. He was presumably retained to be available to the company when his talents became necessary.
Mm-hmm. And when did his talents become necessary?
I don't know.
Okay. Now, he was Mr. Cassano at least officially replaced by Mr. Dooley? Is that accurate?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. Now, did Mr. Cassano, if you know, was he involved at all in the negotiations with the counterparties that were making collateral demands on FP once he became a consultant to the company?
I do not know. I don't believe so.
Okay. Do you know if he was purposely kept out of that?
Do not know.
Okay. Do you know if he ever expressed a desire to continue to be involved in those negotiations? As you may or may not know, I believe he testified in our hearing that he thought he could have made somewhat of a difference.
I'm sure he did.
And I understand that and appreciate that, but do you recall him at the time in February 08, March 08, you know, and going forward, you know, expressing, either hearing from Martin Sullivan or others or directly from Mr. Cassano, hey, you know, let me be involved in the collateral call negotiations?
No.
Okay. So tell me generally then, as we go through 08, of course, we've seen in the documents that, you know, counterparties continue to make more and more calls on the CDS contracts, and then as you get further into 08, you know, the issues arise with the securities lending counterparties too. Can you just sort of walk us through 08 and what's going on with the company in terms of financials and in particular, you know, those two areas and liquidity? And then if you can, just take us through September and when you folks go to the New York Fed.
Well, my recollection is we reported our fourth quarter earnings towards the end of February, which showed a multi-billion dollar loss. And I think from the March to early April timeframe, there was a number of discussions with Mr. Sullivan and the board about the potential to the need for more capital, considering both the losses that were taken in the fourth quarter and concerns about losses that might be taken in the first quarter. So my recollection is much of the discussion with Mr. Sullivan and between the Mr. Sullivan and the board is about the need to raise more capital, which was done sometime in April in a relatively large capital raise that raised almost somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 billion. And then after the capital raise was done, there was some discussions between board members about whether Mr. Sullivan should continue as the CEO. And we had a board meeting, I believe, on the 15th of June and concluded that it was time to make a change.
And so let me stop you there, since I wanted to ask you about that. Can you explain to us what the reasons were for deciding, for the board deciding to make a change at CEO?
Well, I think the board felt that Mr. Sullivan was not, the board felt early on that Mr. Sullivan needed to make some structural changes inside the company and some people issues, and that he was, I'll say, not responding as quickly as they would like.
And what were the people issues, anyway, that he was not responding to quickly enough?
Well, principally, the people issues were Mr. Benzinger, the CFO.
And what were the concerns with Mr. Benzinger?
I think the concern with Mr. Benzinger was he really didn't have the breadth of experience to be a CFO in a company not only this size. I think early on the board was willing to allow him to perform in that job, with the expectation over time is that the experience would be helpful to him and he would develop into a CEO of a company the size of AIG. But obviously the issues in latter 07, early 08 were somewhat overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Any other people? I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
There was some question about whether the company actually should have a chief operating officer as well. And we've kind of urged Mr. Sullivan to look for a chief operating officer.
Other than the concerns about CFO Benzinger and the possible need for a COO, were there other concerns about people issues at the company?
I think, again, there was always a question about resources, whether a lot of these areas were adequately staffed.
And I get that, but I'm more asking about, you know, it seems like there was concern, as you just mentioned, with the performance of Mr. Benzinger as CFO, given the size of the company and the issues with the company. Any similar type concerns with any other individual executives at the company?
And I apologize, but I want to be careful about not adopting the language. And I, you don't need to rephrase the question, Chris. I'm not trying to turn this into a deposition, but I just, what Bob said and what you said are not exactly the same. Perfectly fine for Bob to answer it. I just want to make sure for the record in the future nobody takes him as accepting the particular characterizations of Mr. Benzinger.
Sure.
That you just used. That's what I thought.
Okay.
I'll ask you to repeat the question.
Okay. All right. In addition to one of the people issues being CFO Benzinger, were there other people issues with any other specific executives?
Not that I can recall.
Okay. Do you recall any discussions or concerns about Mr. Lewis, the chief risk officer?
No.
Okay. And same question for Mr. Dooley.
No.
Same question for Mr. Habayeb.
No.
Okay. Same questions for any of the executives at FP other than Mr. Cassana.
No.
Okay.
Sullivan?
We already. Okay. So the decision's made to replace or to have Mr. Sullivan no longer be CEO and you take over as CEO. Explain to us how that decision is made.
Which decision?
Of you taking over for Mr. Sullivan.
Oh. Against my will, actually.
Okay.
So I had been approached by several of the board members about the change, and I was asked if I would consider it. And I, on a number of occasions, said no. I chose not to do that. I subsequently said I would do it on an interim basis. This is to several board members.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the turmoil the company had gone through, as well as the problems it had, I ultimately agreed to take on the responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe you answered this, but let me just ask it to make sure. Why didn't you want to assume the CEO job initially?
When I left Citi, I formed a private equity fund. I had recruited a number of senior people to that business. It was a relatively small operation, and I just felt I had a responsibility to the people in that business not to pick it up and walk out after they had left,
mm-hmm.
you know, very substantial jobs to come and join me.
Okay. And so when you become CEO on I think June 16th, you said in the very beginning of this interview, are you also chairman of the board still also for these next 3 months?
Yes.
Okay. So then let's just go back and continue to walk us through, I guess, the next 3 months in terms of, you know, what's going on liquidity-wise and then eventually as we get into September and the $85 billion loan from the New York Fed.
Well, I spent probably the first 4 weeks after June 16th really meeting with all the management people and kind of, I'll say, digging into the more depth of detail in the financial condition of the company. And, you know, got to the point where I had some concern over liquidity in the event of a liquidity crisis, if you will. So that was largely brought about, in my view anyway, more by securities lending than it was the credit default swap book.
And I guess I don't want to ask why was that. I mean, I know that there's collateral calls coming from both sides. But does that simply mean that there were larger demands for cash on the securities lending business than the CDS business?
No, at the time there wasn't, but the credit default swap book, the demands for collateral were going to be based on the valuation of the securities. In the securities lending business, all it would have required is for the counterparties just to demand their cash back. It had nothing to do with securities valuation. So any of the counterparties who could have concluded that for any number of reasons, their own reason for liquidity issues, the counterparty's liquidity issues, or lack of confidence in AIG, counterparties could have essentially just come in and demanded to have their cash returned to them. Mm-hmm. And that would have been the equivalent of a run on the bank that would have been obviously put AIG into a serious liquidity problem. So it was unrelated to specifically to the valuation of the securities, but more to do with either the condition of the counterparties or their perception of AIG.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so why don't you just continue walking us through until we get through September 16th?
Well, the principal issue that I dealt with through really the whole 91 days, was the potential of a downgrade by the rating agencies. When I had taken over, the first week I was there, I had spoken to all the rating agencies. They expressed some concerns about the ratings and the management change, and that that I had announced on June 16th that I would do a strategic review of the business and respond to the market as to what my plan would be, sometime in September. The rating agencies wanted to know, when they could find out and what my plan was. And I promised to keep them abreast of where we were in that process, which I did. I met with all the rating agencies. My recollection is in the first 10 days of August, mm-hmm. To give them an update on where we were, and that we were, and again, I think the date was something like August 6th or 7th when we were then announcing the second quarter earnings.
Right.
And let the rating agencies know that we were going to have another large loss, and ask them to not take any rating action until I had a chance to kind of disclose what the strategic review of the company was. And the first week of August, they had agreed to do that. Later in the month, Goldman Sachs had put out a report, analyst report, raising questions about liquidity based on the losses that were taken in the second quarter and the collateral calls that could result from it, could result from a rating agency downgrade. And that caused the rating agencies to be extremely concerned, and they had indicated that they weren't sure they could wait till a September a strategic review, and that they were going to consider a ratings review at the end of August.
So who did you talk to at the rating agencies, and what specifically did they tell you, in terms of this Goldman analyst report leading them to not perhaps being able to wait until you communicated to them what the strategic plan was going to be in September?
Well, I don't know if there's anything specific about the Goldman. I don't know that they all referenced the Goldman report, but obviously they raised all the same concerns that were in the Goldman report.
Mm-hmm. So was it more in response to the 2Q08 earnings call?
No, as I mentioned to you, I spoke to all the rating agencies prior to announcing our earnings, and with the clear intent of letting the rating agencies know what was about to take place, and asking for the amount of time necessary to present them a strategic plan, so as not to undertake a review of the company. As I said, they agreed to do that. They later changed their mind towards the end of August, after the Goldman report came out.
Okay. So since they had agreed to wait after you'd given them the preview of 2Q08, what were they saying as the reason why they didn't know if they could wait any longer?
Market conditions. The value of AIG's swaps were going up, there's a market indication of the higher level of risk that was seen at AIG. And they would say kind of market conditions as well.
Okay.
So a lot of, you know, the Lehman issue was floating around the market. The Fannie Freddie issues were floating around the market. So markets were being quite jittery, if you will.
Hey, I'm going to just take this moment to interrupt. And Chris,
sure.
When we originally set this up, Susan and I talked about, she asked me to set aside 90 minutes for this, which is what I did, and so we're coming up about 15 minutes now on 90 minutes, and I'm not suggesting it. I'm going to cut it off at 90 minutes and 1 second, but because people have made other arrangements around this timing, I do want to finish.
Right.
But we got to do it relatively quickly. I mean, the upside to that is the period of time you're now talking about chronologically is something Bob's already testified about publicly at least twice.
Right, and really all I want to do is get through up to September 16th, and then I think we're done. So I think we're on unless something goes terribly wrong, I think 15 minutes will be just fine. So let's just keep going. So you have this conversation with the rating agency sometime in late August, and they say they might not be able to wait. So just, again, finish the story and take us through the rest of August and through September.
Well, the rating agencies indicated, I'd say, around Labor Day or thereabouts, that they were going to review the ratings of the company. And, of course, a downgrade meant as much as $13 to $18 billion of additional collateral.
Mm-hmm.
That was obviously the short-term immediate concern. After Labor Day, my recollection was September 6th or 7th was when Fannie and Freddie were put into conservatorship, I guess is the term.
Right, Sunday the 7th.
7th, right. That really shook up the credit markets and... all the signals from the rating agencies were that they were going to downgrade the company. And so that week, we had started to do some preparation to go out and raise some additional capital, because obviously another $18 billion would be a big deal for the company.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent that week and the weekend of the 13th and 14th trying to raise capital on our own. We were unsuccessful at doing that. And then on Monday, we had a meeting with the Fed to let them know. We had spoken to the Fed over the weekend. But on Monday, we had told the Fed that we had been unsuccessful. Actually, I think we told them Sunday night, and Monday the Fed held a meeting with Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan in an effort to try and get a group of banks together, with the Fed's urging to find a private solution to the AIG problem. That also was unsuccessful, which brought us up to Tuesday the 16th. And the end result is what we all know.
And so when did AIG first approach the New York Fed or whoever else was in the government to broach the subject of government assistance?
I had a conversation with Tim Geithner on Friday the 12th. To tell him that I thought that we were likely to be downgraded and AIG did not have the cash, the liquidity to meet that call. And in the absence of that, we would have been in default of our agreements, which, the dire consequences would have put us into bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have seen some documents that indicate over the weekend there wasn't, and you had mentioned J.P. Morgan and Goldman, That there was an attempt at a private sector solution. We've also seen reference to Mr. Flowers and maybe even Mr. Buffett. But can you talk to us or explain if there was any attempt at a private sector solution beyond what you've already told us in terms of Goldman and J.P. Morgan?
Now, why this is so confusing to everybody, I don't understand. But I thought it was pretty clearly both in past testimony and God knows how many books have been written. The Goldman J.P. Morgan solution did not take place, or attempt did not take place until Monday. The efforts over the weekend of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday were a private solution initiated by AIG. What took place on Monday was an attempt by the Fed to get Goldman and J.P. Morgan to put together a syndicate of banks to find a, quote, private solution.
Mm-hmm.
There were two distinct efforts.
Okay, and do you know, I mean, as you said, on Tuesday, that the 16th, the $85 billion loan is made, and the terms of that appear to be similar to documents we see for one of those two private sector solutions. Do you know whether it was based on the Goldman J.P. Morgan private consortium deal that didn't happen or the private sector deal worked on during the weekend?
You know, I've heard that reported, but I never saw any documents out of a Goldman J.P. Morgan private sector solution.
Mm-hmm.
I have my own judgment that that was a viable solution.
Which one was a viable solution?
Well, the so-called document that was what I had heard was reported was that would have been same terms as a private sector solution.
Okay. And what was your understanding of why neither of the private sector solutions worked?
It's almost hard to even answer that question. Why a private sector solution? The day after Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, the day after Merrill Lynch was taken over by B of A, and the absolute turmoil in the markets.
Well, for example, did the folks at J.P. Morgan and Goldman say, "Look, for exactly the reasons you're now discussing, we're just not willing to do this deal anymore, given the disruption in the markets caused by the Lehman bankruptcy and Merrill being taken over by B of A, et cetera"?
Well, I never got an answer back. They were dealing with the Fed at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So all I heard was that there was no solution.
Okay. What about the folks over the weekend? Did they actually make an offer that was rejected, or did no offer ever come?
Well, there were a number of discussions, and there was, I would say, some reasonable progress over the weekend towards raising capital. But at the end, any of the individuals or companies that were prepared to commit capital to AIG wanted to be assured that AIG would survive. And the only guarantor, if you will, that could have done that would have been the Fed or the Treasury, and
so,
they refused to do that.
So did the folks looking to make an offer or looking to buy the company over the weekend, was that part of their deal, that the Fed or the Treasury provide some type of assistance or guarantee that the company would survive?
Yes.
Okay. And did it ever get to the point, if you know, where, you know, here's a term sheet, you know, that has to be approved by the AIG board, that has to be signed off on by the Treasury and or the Fed?
No, we had several meetings over the course of the weekend on Saturday and Sunday to let the Fed know what progress we were making. And we thought that we could raise as much as $30 billion of additional capital. Of course, at the time, we thought somewhere between 30 and 40 was going to be necessary. It wasn't until the markets opened on Monday and the collapse in the markets drove down the value of all these securities in the AIG portfolio that escalated the value to what was determined to be 85 on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout that weekend, both in discussions with Geithner and Paulson, they both indicated there would be no public solution for AIG.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a moot point. There was no point in getting a term sheet at that juncture because we had been told at the most senior levels that there would be no public solution.
So who were the entities that were the possible private sector solution over the weekend? Not the Goldman, J.P. Morgan folk, but the others. We've seen Flowers and we've seen mention of Buffett. Was it them? Was it someone else?
Well, we talked to Flowers and Buffett. There were probably a dozen or so different private equity firms and potential investors in over the weekend. The biggest source of liquidity for the company at that point in time actually was the effort put in by the New York State Insurance Commissioner, who got permission to allow securities that were being held in the regulated insurance companies to be used as collateral for loans that would have provided somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 billion worth of liquidity.
And for the record, that's Mr. DiNalo, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And who was there someone willing to lend against those securities?
Well, we had had discussions with J.P. Morgan, who was kind of acting as our agent. They had been engaged by AIG to act as our bankers. And I think the belief was that pledging government securities, they and others, Citi, would lend against it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, did Mr. Flowers and his group actually ever make an offer?
Flowers and who?
His group.
Oh. Well, Flowers delivered a letter with a so-called offer, but it was, I think, deemed by both the management and the board to be not a serious effort.
Mm-hmm.
It was contingent upon a number of governmental agencies taking an active role in the financing.
Mm-hmm. So what was, did the board even respond to the offer?
Well, it was presented to the board and the board, you know, dismissed it, I'd say, you know, immediately just because it had a whole series of contingencies that had already been rejected by the Fed and Treasury.
Ah, okay. And that would have been, I take it, on Sunday?
My recollection was it was Sunday night, but I'm not sure if it was Sunday or Monday.
Okay.
Hey, Chris, it's Jamie Gamble. I just want to, just for clarity on the record, one of the things I think has come across that I think should be very clear is that when you talk about an offer being made, the number of items that were, for lack of a better word, up in the air over the course of that weekend and the interdependencies were enormous. And so, Don't get in your mind the idea of an offer or a sheet that came in that this is how we would execute the entire transaction.
Mm-hmm.
There were pieces in different places, and the responsibility for coordinating all that really was not being done by any equity offer, or was really being done by the company with interacting with regulators and the Fed and the Treasury. It's just a lot of people doing a lot of stuff. This is not a bidding situation where somebody just walked in and said, here's a deal.
Right, right. Okay.
Take it or leave it.
Thank you. So I want to just ask you a couple things on a different subject now, and that is the OTS. Generally, what kind of interactions did you have with the OTS while you were a board member and then CEO, one, and then two, what interactions were you having with the OTS during this final week in September of 2008?
There, as a board member, there were several meetings, I would say as a matter of course, with the OTS as the regulator of the company. I can say to you that certainly as CEO, I never spoke to the OTS.
Okay, so then from June through the $85 billion loan on September 16th and when you leave the company, no communications with the OTS?
That's correct.
Okay, and then from February of 06 through June of 08 when you're a director or chairman of the board, did you ever get any reports from the OTS, you know, that voiced concerns about AIG?
The OTS, I think, I think it was an annual review of the company. I don't recall any specifics about issues within the company that went beyond what I would say is kind of normal regulatory review.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I find it a little curious that there's no discussions between the OTS and the CEO of the company in the June to September time frame. Any opinions on why that is?
Well, I didn't call them, and they didn't call me. I guess that's the best I can give you right now.
Where, if you know, was the OTS at the, were anybody from the OTS at the New York Fed that last weekend?
I don't believe, certainly on Saturday or Sunday, anybody from the OTS was there.
Okay. Understanding that you didn't have conversations with the OTS once you were CEO, do you know if other executives at the company were, and in particular, you know, in this last week before the $85 billion loan?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. And then, as we get very near the end, why do you leave on September 16th? Was that your choice, or was it part of the deal?
I was terminated by Mr. Paulson.
And were you given any reason why you were terminated?
No.
Did you ever come to learn why you were terminated?
No.
Okay. Did you ask?
No.
Mr. Willemstadt, I see we're about a minute 40 over. I apologize for going over. Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. Hey, Chris, and just to reiterate what we said earlier, you guys said you were going to send us quickly a copy of the recording here, and we'll go through it, and pursuant to my conversation with Gary Cohen, we'll demark the stuff that we think is problematic from a litigation perspective, and ask that you not release that publicly for the 3-year period that Gary and I discussed.
Sure.
Where you weren't there, so you can't talk about that.
Right. Well, I can definitely get you the recording, and then, as I said before, definitely talk to Gary about, you know, how the recording will be dealt with by the FCIC.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.